It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Singer-songwriter Billy Bragg is well known for his punk rock protest songs and artful ballads, commenting on the human condition in his native England and elsewhere. His career took an interesting turn in the late 90s when Woody Guthrie's daughter Nora asked Bragg to set some of her father's unrecorded lyrics to music. The result was the collaboration with the band Wilco and Natalie Merchant for the Grammy-nominated albums Mermaid Avenue and Mermaid Avenue Volume 2. He released a new album earlier this year called Tooth and Nail, and he's back in Pittsburgh for the first time since 1997, appearing at Mr. Small's and with us in Studio A. Billy Bragg, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Is it really 1997, Paul? Crikey.
I know.
It's a long time, isn't it?
It is. What took you? Well, it's been 16 years.
What happens is when you're young, free and single, you can go anywhere in the world. But when you're someone's dad, you have to there are some places that you go to every now and then that fall off. And I'm sorry to say that Pittsburgh is up there with Spain, Italy, Scandinavia, New Zealand. You know, there were just some places where it would take – I'd need to be away for 6 weeks rather than 3 weeks. And I prioritize my family. And, you know, I think that I have no qualms about that. I'm just sorry it's taken me a long time to get back here. But we didn't forget Pittsburgh was here.
And Pittsburgh hasn't forgotten you. It seems like you're a good fit for this town. Pittsburghers don't mince words. You are a very straightforward storyteller. Have you found that tends to get a positive response from people in a city like this?
Yeah, it does. I mean, particularly in the industrial heartlands. I mean, the town I come from, although it's very close by London, is heavily industrialized. It was dominated by a car company, Ford's, at Dagenham. And when I left school, they were employing 40,000 people, and now they only employ 4,000. So the change there has been considerable. And you can see that in Western Pennsylvania, that same sort of, you know, post-industrial regrowth. We're staying out by the Strip, and it's kind of a lovely mixture there of sort of like, you know, new nightclubs and coffee shops with old style. There's a candy shop there that claims to have been there since 1642, Fort Pitt. And for some reason, shops selling loads of football shirts and baseball shirts. I don't know if there's something going on or, you know, something crazy is happening. But yeah, so I was one point today, I was going down there finding coffee, where I think I may have been the only person within a 100-yard radius who didn't have either a Pirates or a Steelers something on, you know. So I stood out like a stupid Englishman. But yeah, I like that. It is quite similar to where I come from, that vibe.
Your arrival in the States, this tour that you're on, it coincides with the culmination of some contentious political times in the United States that you might have heard something about. What do you make of the whole Obamacare debate in America?
Well, I think it's very difficult for those of us outside the United States of America to understand why you don't have universal health care. It seems to me to be something that is an absolute bedrock of not only a fair society, but a stable society. The figures show that you spend twice as much as other countries on healthcare, and you get worse service. You get amongst the worst rates of recovery than in the developed world. So clearly, your healthcare system isn't working as it's currently configured. And to take the burden of payment away from people who are ill, some who are terminally ill, I think would be, you know, if I were an activist here, I think that would be the prime thing to work towards, to work, you know, the whole way, not just Obamacare, but to a universal healthcare paid for from progressive taxation. Because in the end, you know, it's about what sort of society you want to live in. Do you want to live in a compassionate society where we care for one another? Or do you want to live in a devil-take-the-hindmost society? And I think, you know, my experience is there's certainly enough compassionate people in the United States of America to create a universal healthcare system. And it's not, we believe in individualism in the UK, and of course in Canada and other countries, but we happen to believe that unless each individual is the recipient of free healthcare, free education, access to decent housing, affordable housing, and a proper pension, then only the rich and powerful will get to express their individuality, and the rest of us will be exploited by them. So it's not perfect, and it's not easy to sustain, you know, because one of the things it does, it makes people live longer. So, you know, there are costs involved in that. But as a society, we're committed to caring for one another. And that's not, you know, anti-American.
You say if it wasn't for Margaret Thatcher, you wouldn't be a socialist. Mm. How did you attain your liberal views. And how much did Margaret Thatcher have to do with that?
Well, I already had broadly what you might call liberal views. I mean, liberal in my country is quite a watered-down word. You know, a liberal is just someone who leans from the centre. So I'm a little bit more than that. But, you know, I basically fundamental humanitarian views that I developed as a kid, you know, listening to political songwriters from the 60s, reading the newspapers about the Vietnam War and stuff like that. But it really took the miners' strike in 1984, 1985 to properly politicise me and open my eyes to the way that society works rather than just have a general sort of feeling of positiveness towards people. And that was really because Margaret Thatcher was threatening all those things that I'd grown up to take for granted, the things I just listed, free healthcare, re-education, proper housing, pensions. She was attacking all of those things. And I suddenly realised that I shouldn't really take them for granted. I should really be out there doing what I can to stand up for them and to defend them, you know. And the way we were talking in those days, the politics that I had were defined as democratic socialism. Now, you know, socialism, as far as I'm concerned, although it has a very strong input from left, you know, the left thinkers like Marx, really, if it's not at heart a form of organized compassion, then it's not really worthy of the name. You know, and ultimately, as a socialist, what I want to do is create a fairer society and make sure that the things that we were, you know, that our parents left to us, those things I spoke, what we call broadly the welfare state, those ideas are passed on to the next generation, and that we don't lose them. We don't go back to a time when people are having to worry about going to the doctors if they can pay their bills or not. You know, we don't want to go back to a time like that. So that's why I'm a socialist. If you're asking why, where it comes from, it's in defense of those ideas rather than, you know, I didn't study Marx. I didn't do politics at school. I left school when I was 16. But I recognize that, you know, the great challenge for us is if we're going to live in a capitalist society, and I don't have a problem with that, the question then becomes how do we hold those who have power in that society to account? How do we hold the corporations to account? How do we hold the bankers to account? You know, that seems to me that, you know, you fought a civil war over these kind of issues. You know, you fought a war of independence over accountability. We chopped our king's head off because he wouldn't be accountable to our parliament. So accountability is, beyond just democracy and freedom, actually being able to hold people to account for the things they have done, is the ultimate, that's to me is the ultimate currency of liberty. If you don't have that ability to hold people to account, maybe you're not really free.
Is that part of what fueled that struggle? Is that part of what fueled your song Ideology, which I noticed you reworked this year?
Yeah, we're opening with it, yeah.
When one voice rules the nation, just because they're top of the pile, doesn't mean their vision is the clearest.
The ideological struggles of the 1980s are over. But and, you know, and I always thought the most unideological place in the world was the United States of America. When I came here in the 80s, I was here in the year of the miners' strike. To look at your politics, I couldn't tell the difference between the two parties at all. You know, it didn't make any sense to a European's perspective of politics. But I now realise that what's happening now, this week, with the shutdown, is purely ideological. There are a strong ideological strand in American politics, but it's not. It doesn't come from a left-right, but it's clear that there's an ideology behind the attempts to stymie Obama's plans for healthcare. That's an ideological difference. Now, it's different from what we had in the 80s, but it still is an ideology.
Who were the songwriters that influenced you growing up? You talked about listening to songs and following the Vietnam War protests in the 60s. So was it American songwriters?
Predominantly, yeah. I mean, the first songwriter that I really connected with was Paul Simon, listening to Simon and Garfunkel when I was about 11 years old. Bridge Over Troubled Water came out, and The Box, I heard The Box on the radio, and it's the first song that gave me that strange feeling where you think, oh, my God, someone's been reading my mail or something like that, you know, that weird thing that as a songwriter you want to instill in your listener. And from Dylan, from Paul Simon, it didn't take long to get to Bob Dylan. And once you get to Bob Dylan, then there's a whole hinterland of great singer-songwriters beyond him writing in the 1960s. But equally important were people like Smokey Robinson and the songwriters at Motown and at Stax, because in some ways, you know, you couldn't listen to 60s American soul pop without being infused with the politics of the civil rights movement. If you buy the compiled album Tamla Motown Chout Busters Volume 4, I Want You Back by the Jackson 5 goes into War by Edwin Starr, which then comes out and goes into Stone Love by the Supremes and goes into Ball of Confusion by the Temptations. And to anyone like myself who was early teens listening to lyrics, I'm discerning there's something going on here. What is it? What's going on that's causing this expression, you know, in the highest reaches of pop music even? Politics is here, so to look into that, you know, and that, on that same, I mean, the clues are all there, because on that same album, Chartbusters Volume 4, Marvin Gaye sings Abraham, Martin and John, and you're brought right into what's going on here. You know, if there was any ambiguity before that you didn't understand from your perspective, Marvin nails it.
Has anybody here seen my old friend Martin? Can you tell me where he's gone?
So we're hearing some of the ingredients and the early influences on you, and then the Clash comes along, and that sort of takes you in.
Yeah, punk rock kind of wakes everything up again. I mean, by the mid-70s, music in the UK was getting a bit flabby, getting a bit boring. Hair was getting long, so were guitar solos. And we needed a bit of a jolt of reality, you know. And the Clash and bands like them provided it, but particularly for me, the Clash, yeah. And the Jam. The Jam were pretty big as well for me.
Apparently it was after you joined the British Army that you became more determined to be a songwriter. What happened?
Well, my punk band, a little punk band that was in Riff Raff, kind of disintegrated, and I ended up back at my mum's house with no job and no prospects. So in order to try and push the eject button on my previous existence, I signed up to the Royal Armoured Corps to become a tank driver. Now, this may sound a bit strange, but...
How'd that go for you?
Well, when you've driven one tank, you've driven them all. Oh, I have to tell you, mate, it's not that engaging a thing. I also was hoping it would stop me pretending to want to be a singer-songwriter. But actually, when I got there, I just found it was more inspiring. I was writing more songs, getting more ideas, and realised that I would have to... In the British Army, it's a volunteer army, so you can buy yourself out. So when they paid me at the end of my basic training, then I used that money to buy myself out.
How much did you have to put up?
£175. Under current numbers, it would be about £250.
Oh, that's not too
less,
bad.
Less than that, probably.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is singer-songwriter Billy Bragg. How challenging is it for a guy like you to record an album in this day and age?
It's tough. I'm you know, self-financed. So it's not just recording an album, Paul. It's promoting the album too. You know, if you get the money together to record the album, you're probably going to need to get that much together again to pay for some adverts and to take a band out on the road and tour it for a year. Because the sort of places I play, if I'm touring with a band, I'm not making money. And touring is how I usually make a living. So before you can, you know, I recorded the album in January 2012, but it took me until a year later to get enough of a sort of fund together to be able to tour for 18 months and, you know, be sitting here now, pay for this. You know, so it's tough. You got to really
money
think
well
about
spent
it.
Though being
well,
here.
Thank you very much. I think so. Certainly, coming to America and this is the second time we've been here this year. The response has been really, really positive to the band and to the album. So I feel it's been very worthwhile.
There's a very touching song on the album, Tooth and Nail. It's called January Song. Mm. What can you tell us about the story behind it?
Well, it's the very last song we wrote in the sessions, and it was. The album came at the end of the year in which my mother had passed away. And although the album isn't really about that, it became the thing that I did to move on. At the end of it all, and we packed everything away, me and my brother, and we'd got my nephew's son into mum's house and all the stuff had been put away and everything. I thought, you know, I really need to do something now to move on to the next thing from this. And so I rang my friend Joe Henry and reminded him that he'd sort of dared me to come and make an album in 5 days in his basement. Said, Joe, you know what? I think I might be ready to come and spend some time in your basement. So that got me focused on writing songs. Then I got over there and it was went amazingly. I think by the third day we had 10 songs. So I figured if I wrote a couple more songs, we might get a, you know, get an album out of this. And so on, January song was the very last song I wrote, and then on the very last day of recording, a line came up in the song, you know, when she's buried in her dancing shoes, my mum went ballroom dancing a lot in her life. It was just a little, just a little something to put in there so that people who knew me would know that, you know, I was in that particular position, reflecting on that moment. I'm so tired of being wired, but there's so much that I have to do. Tidy up the place for Monday when she's buried in her dancing shoes. And it sort of set the tone for the record, because it is about, you know, it starts, I'm so tightly wound in tension, but it is looking to the future and, you know, saying, you know, I'm gonna find a way through this and get out the other side. So, and January, you know, it's the start of the year, start of things, so a new start. So, you know, all those things. And also I told Joe that I really wanted to make an album that sounded like a Fred Neil record. And it's probably the only one that sounds anywhere near, anything near Fred Neil. So I was really pleased at last to just get that Fred Neil thing out of my system, because I've been listening to a lot of Fred Neil beforehand, and I just love the sound of the records he made.
You wrote a song that was a tribute to your father called Tank Park Salute. And yep. I can't listen to that song without crying. And I imagine that it was very emotional for you to write that song as well.
It was, yeah, except it was like years after my dad passed away that that song came up. One of the strange things about that was it took me a long time to write. It was many years after my dad had passed away. And one of the reasons for that was because I never ever spoke to people about it. It was one of the things that I just internalized. But writing the song kind of forced me to speak to people about it. And that's a good thing. You shouldn't internalize those kind of things. So when, as happened at Kent in Ohio on Sunday night, a woman in the front row totally broke down in tears, and I was talking to her after, I was saying, no, that's a good thing, because, you know, I wrote that song so that we can both of us get in touch with those feelings, both you and I. So it's a good thing that you know, it opened the floodgates for you. I think, you know, I don't think we get in touch with those feelings often enough, particularly as men. So, you know, it's a very important song in the set.
Like a pale moon in a sunny sky, death gazes down as I pass by to remind me that I'm but my father's son. I offer up to you this tribute. I offer up to you this Tank Park Salute.
It's Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is 90.5 WESA. My guest is singer-songwriter Billy Bragg. You did a song called Everywhere on Don't Try This at Home. And it's about a California kid whose best friend is a Japanese American, someone he idolizes, and what happens to them after the attack on Pearl Harbor. I'll let you pick up the story.
Yeah, he's interned. The friend is interned while the guy, the song singer, goes to fight in the South Pacific. And sadly, the Marine dies, and the guy who's been interned ultimately takes his own life. And it's really about, I think it's about belonging, which I think is more important than other issues of nationality and race. It's about where you belong and how much you feel you belong. I mean, in our own country, we're having this issue at the moment, and it's exemplified by the leader of the Labour Party, whose father was a refugee from the Nazis, who later became a Marxist intellectual. And the Daily Mail, one of our daily newspapers, I think I can say a rather cynical daily newspaper, castigated him, his father, who's now dead, for being, you know, a traitor to the country because he was a Marxist. And yet he's, you know, he served in the Royal Navy during the Second World War against the Nazis. So, you know, those who would divide us are doing so on very, very shallow grounds. And actually, when it comes down to communities and individuals and what you'll stand for and what you'll fight for, I think in the end it's about where you are that becomes more important than where you're from or where your parents or your grandparents are from. You know, that's the sort of society I prefer to live in, rather than one that divides people, one that brings people together in a more cohesive idea of what society should be.
I know that I've been pulling some examples from Don't Try This at Home, but that was the album that really put you on the radar for a lot of us here in the States. And I can remember driving on I-35 in Minnesota the first time I heard Sexuality, which became a hit song for you. And I've been waiting for over 20 years to ask you how you came up with the all-time most outrageous rock and roll rhyme, "I look like Robert De Niro, I drive a Mitsubishi Zero."
Well, the keys is at the very end of the song. So clearly I was running out of material and rhymes. And so Robert De Niro got in, so Mitsubishi Zero managed to get in there now. Although actually now when I'm singing live, I actually say Mitsubishi Pajero because it's a better line. Now, I wish I'd said it at the time. But
Billy Bragg, it's great to have you in Pittsburgh. Great to have had you on Essential Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for stopping
by.
My
pleasure to be here, Paul. Thanks for having me in.